George Adamski, Inside the Spaceships, first published in 1956. Remark. This is interpreted to not be on our pure physical level, or the coarse physical dimension as we, or most people on Earth, are trapped into. 1. Return of the Venusian. Los Angeles is a city of lights and noise, of rush and restlessness, in striking contrast to the quiet starlight and peace of my mountain home. It was February 18, 1953. I had not come to the city for excitement, but because I had been drawn there by the kind of urgent impression described in Flying Saucers Have Landed. Following a custom of many years when visiting Los Angeles, I registered in a certain downtown hotel. After the bellboy has brought my suitcase to the room, received his tip and departed, I stood uncertainly in the middle of the floor. It was only about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and since I literally did not know what had brought me here, I felt rather at a loose end. I went over to the window and stood staring out at the busy street. There certainly was no inspiration there. Coming to a sudden decision, I went downstairs, crossed the lobby and wandered into the cocktail lounge. The attendant knew me and, although originally skeptical, after talking with me and seeing my photographs of the saucers, had become keenly interested. He greeted me cordially. After we had chatted a bit, he said that a number of people had become interested in his saucer reports and had asked him to give them a call if I should come in. He waited for my reaction and I hardly knew what to say. Momentarily at least, I had no plans. While I did not feel particularly like giving an informal lecture to a group of strangers, on the other hand it seemed as good a way as any to pass the time while waiting for, well, whatever I was waiting for. I gave my consent and soon quite a gathering of men and women had assembled. Their interest seemed sincere and I answered their questions to the best of my ability. It was nearly 7 o'clock when I excused myself and went a short way down the street to have dinner. I chose to be alone, with only the persistent feeling of something is going to happen for company. After eating in a half-hearted kind of way, I returned to the hotel. There was no one in the lobby whom I knew, and the bar had no further attraction for me. Suddenly, I remembered Missam, a young lady student of mine who lived in the city. She had been unable to come up to our mountain place for some time and had asked me to call her when next I came down. I went into a telephone booth and dialed her number. She seemed delighted to hear from me. Having no car, however, she explained that it might be an hour or so before she could arrive by streetcar. I bought an evening paper and, to avoid encountering anyone who might recognize me, I took it up to my room. After I had read what was of interest to me, I forced myself to wade through items I would ordinarily have skipped, this in an attempt to discipline the restlessness which now permeated my entire consciousness. Before the hour was up, I went down to the lobby to wait for Miss M, and she arrived about 15 minutes later. We talked for quite a while and I succeeded in straightening her out in regard to a number of problems which, locked in her mind, had grown out of all proportion. Her gratitude was touching and she told me that she had constantly been holding the thought and hope that I would come to the city and help her. As I walked with her to the corner where she took the streetcar, I wondered if the urge that had reached me in the mountains could possibly have been her telepathic message getting through. But when I was quiet again in the hotel lobby, I knew this could not be the explanation. That feeling was still with me, stronger than ever. I looked at my wristwatch and saw that it said 10:30. The lateness of the hour, with still nothing of extraordinary significance having taken place, sent a wave of disappointment through me. And just at this moment of depression, two men approached, one of whom addressed me by name. Both were complete strangers, but there was no hesitancy in their manner as they came forward, and nothing in their appearance to indicate that they were other than average young businessmen. Because I had lectured in Los Angeles, made appearances on radio and TV, and also been visited by a great many people from that city at my Palomar Gardens home, such an approach from strangers was not an uncommon experience. I noted that both men were well proportioned. One was slightly over 6 feet and looked to be in his early 30s. His complexion was ruddy, his eyes dark brown, with the kind of sparkle that suggests great enjoyment of life. His gaze was extraordinarily penetrating. His black hair waved and was cut according to our style. He wore a dark brown business suit but no hat. The shorter man looked younger and I judged his height to be about 5 feet, 9 inches. He had a round boyish face, a fair complexion and eyes of greyish blue. His hair, also wavy and worn in our style, was sandy in color. He was dressed in a grey suit and was also hatless. He smiled as he addressed me by name. As I acknowledged the greeting, the speaker extended his hand and when it touched mine a great joy filled me. The signal was the same as had been given by the man I had met on the desert on that memorable November 20, 1952. This is described in the book Flying Saucers Have Landed. An extract from this book of Adamski's first meeting with a space brother is available at the end of this main text. Consequently, I knew that these men were not inhabitants of Earth. Nevertheless, I felt entirely at ease as we shook hands and the younger man said, "We were to meet you. Have you time to come with us?" Without a question in my mind, nor the slightest apprehension, I said, "I place myself entirely in your hands." Together we left the lobby, I walking between them. About a block north of the hotel, they turned into a parking lot where they had a car waiting. They had not spoken during this short time, yet inwardly I knew that these men were true friends. I felt no urge to ask where they proposed to take me, nor did it seem odd that they had volunteered no information. An attendant brought the car around, and the younger man slid into the driver's seat, motioning me to get in beside him. Our other companion also sat with us on the front seat. The car was a four-door black Pontiac sedan. The man who had taken the wheel seemed to know exactly where he was going and drove skillfully. I am not familiar with all the new highways leading out of Los Angeles, so I had no idea in which direction we were headed. We rode in silence and I remained entirely content to wait for my companions to identify themselves and explain the reason for our meeting. I realized that such a trusting attitude ordinarily would seem foolhardy in the light of the lawlessness rampant in our world today. But it was an attitude followed by men of other civilizations in the presence of men recognized to possess greater wisdom than they. This custom has also been practiced by the American Indians to show respect and humility, patience and faith. I understood this well and conducted myself accordingly, since in the presence of these men I sensed a power which made me feel like a child in the company of beings of vast wisdom and compassion. Lights and dwellings thinned as we left the outskirts of the city. The taller man spoke for the first time as he said, "You have been very patient. We know how much you are wondering who we are and where we are taking you." I acknowledged that of course I had been wondering, but added that I was entirely content to wait for this information until they chose to give it to me. The speaker smiled and indicated the driver. "He is from the planet you call Mars. I am from the one you call Saturn." His voice was soft and pleasant and his English perfect. I had noticed that the younger man also spoke softly, although his voice was pitched higher. I found myself wondering how and where they had learned to speak our language so well. As the thought passed through my mind, it was immediately recognized. The Martian now spoke for the first time since our meeting in the hotel. "We are what you on Earth might call contact men. We live and work here, because, as you know, it is necessary on Earth to earn money with which to buy clothing, food, and the many things that people must have. We have lived on your planet now for several years. At first we did have a slight accent. But that has been overcome and, as you can see, we are unrecognized as other than Earthmen. At our work and in our leisure time we mingle with people here on Earth, never betraying the secret that we are inhabitants of other worlds. That would be dangerous, as you well know. We understand you people better than most of you know yourselves and can plainly see the reasons for many of the unhappy conditions that surround you. We are aware that you yourself have faced ridicule and criticism because of your persistence in proclaiming the reality of human life on other planets, which your scientists say are incapable of maintaining life. So you can well imagine what would happen to us if we so much as hinted that our homes are on other planets. If we stated the simple truth, that we have come to your Earth to work and to learn, just as some of you go to other nations to live and to study, we would be labeled insane. We are permitted to make brief visits to our home planets. Just as you long for a change of scene or to see old friends, so it is with us. It is necessary, of course, to arrange such absences during official holidays, or even over a weekend, so that we will not be missed by our associates here on Earth. I did not ask whether my companions were married and had families here on our planet, but I had an impression that this was not the case. For a few minutes, silence again remained unbroken as I thought over the information they had given me. I found myself wondering why I had been singled out to receive their friendship and been given this knowledge by men from other worlds. Whatever the reason, I felt very humble, and very grateful. As I was thinking about all this, the Saturnian gently said, "You are neither the first nor the only man on this world with whom we have talked. There are many others living in different parts of the earth to whom we have come. Some who have dared to speak of their experiences have been persecuted, a few even unto what you call death. Consequently, many have kept silent. But when the book on which you are now working reaches the public, the story of your first contact out on the desert with our brother from the planet which you call Venus will encourage others from many countries to write you of their experiences. After the first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, was published, the truth of this prediction was proven. I felt not only a strong confidence in these new friends, but an overwhelming sense that we were not actually strangers to one another. I also had a deep conviction that these men could answer all questions and solve all problems concerning our world, even to performing feats impossible to Earthmen if they deemed such necessary and in keeping with the mission they had come to perform. We drove on smooth highways for a long time, possibly an hour and a half. I still had no idea in what direction we were traveling, except a sense that we were entering desert country. It was too dark to observe details of the surroundings. My mind continued to be absorbed in reviewing what they had told me and, as I have said before, there was little conversation. I was jarred out of my musings when, suddenly, we turned off the smooth highway into a rough, narrow, corrugated road. The Martian said, "We have a surprise for you. We passed no cars on this road, along which we drove for about 15 minutes. Then, with mounting excitement, I saw in the distance a soft white glowing object on the ground. We stopped within about 50 feet of it. I estimated it to be some 15 to 20 feet in height and I recognized its close resemblance to the saucer, or scout ship, of my first meeting almost 3 months earlier. As we came to a stop, I noticed that a man was standing on the ground beside the glowing craft. After we had stepped out of the car, my companions called out a greeting. The man by the scout ship appeared to be working on something connected with it. The three of us walked toward him and, to my great joy, I recognized my friend of the first contact, the man from Venus. He was dressed in the same ski-type flying suit that he had worn on the first occasion, but this suit was light brown in color with orange stripes at top and bottom of the waistband. His radiant smile made it clear that he shared my happiness over this reunion. After greetings were exchanged, he said, "As we were coming down, a small part of this little ship broke, so I have been making a new one while waiting for you to arrive." I watched curiously as he emptied the contents of a small crucible onto the sand. "The timing was perfect," he said. "I was just completing the installation as you drove up." It suddenly struck me that he was speaking English with only a slight trace of accent, whereas on our first meeting he seemed unable to speak our language at all. I hoped that he might explain this, but as he did not, I refrained from questioning. Instead, I stooped and cautiously touched what appeared to be a very small amount of molten metal which he had thrown out. Although still quite warm, it was not too hot to be handled, and I carefully wrapped it in my handkerchief, which I placed safely in an inner pocket of my coat. I still have this bit of metal in my possession. Although my companions were laughing at my antics, there was no trace of ridicule in their merriment. The Venusian asked, although he must have known the answer, "Why do you want that?" I explained that I hoped it might furnish proof of the reality of their visit and told him that people usually demanded what they called concrete evidence to prove that I was not just making it all up when I told of my first meeting with him. Still smiling, he answered, "Yes. And you are a race of souvenir hunters, aren't you? However, You will find that this alloy contains the same metals found on your Earth, since they are much the same on all planets. Here, I believe, is as good a moment as any to say to my readers that no names, as we know them, were given to me for any of the people I met from other worlds. The reason for this was explained to me but cannot be given here in full. Suffice it to state that there is no involved mystery connected with this but rather an entirely different concept of names as we use them. While this no-name state created no awkwardness in my actual encounters with these new friends, I realize that it certainly would do so for the reader, especially in the latter part of this book as contacts mount. Therefore, since we of this world are dependent on our own kind of names for one another, I shall provide them. While I want to make it very clear that the names I am introducing for these new friends are not their correct names, I wish to add that I have my own good reasons for choosing them, and that they are not without meaning in relation to those who will bear them throughout these pages. The Martian I shall call Firkn. The Saturnian is Ram. My name for the Venusian will be Orthon. Inside a Venusian scout ship shortly after our arrival, Orthon turned and entered the ship, motioning for me to join him. Firkn and Ram immediately followed. As I have stated, the scout rested solidly on the ground and only a small step up was required to enter the craft. Although when we had first reached the waiting scout, I must have anticipated something of this kind, now that I was actually aboard, my joy can only be imagined. As I took a first quick glance around, I wondered if their purpose was merely to show me what one of these scouts looked like inside, or, I hardly dared let the hope live, perhaps actually to take me on a journey through space. We went directly into the one-room cabin compartment through a door high enough to permit Ram, the tall Saturnian, to enter without stooping. As he, the last to go in, placed his foot on the cabin floor, the door silently closed. I was aware of a very slight hum that seemed to come equally from beneath the floor and from a heavy coil that appeared to be built into the top of the circular wall. The moment the hum started, this coil began to glow bright red but emitted no heat. I recalled that I had noticed just such a bright coil on the scout of my first contact. But on that occasion it had thrown off various colors, red, blue and green, like a flashing prism in the sunday. I scarcely knew where to look first. I marveled anew at the unbelievable way in which they were able to fit parts together so that joinings were imperceptible. Just as I had been unable to find any trace of an entrance door into the scout of my first encounter, now there was no sign of the door that had closed behind us, only what looked like solid wall. Everything had seemed to take place simultaneously, the door closing, the soft hum as of a swarm of bees, the glow of the upper coil and the increase of light within the craft. It was all so exciting that I was obliged to take myself firmly in hand in order to concentrate on any one thing. I wanted to leave this ship with a clear picture of everything in order to give a lucid account of what I was seeing. I estimated the inside diameter of the cabin to be approximately 18 feet. A pillar about 2 feet thick extended downward from the very top of the dome to the center of the floor. Later I was told that this was the magnetic pole of the ship, by means of which they drew on nature's forces for propulsion purposes, but they did not explain how this was done. The top of the pole, Firkn pointed out, is normally positive, while the bottom, which you will notice goes down through the floor, is negative. But, when necessary, these poles can be reversed merely by pushing a button. I noticed that a good 6 feet of the central floor was occupied by a clear, round lens through which the magnetic pole was centered. On opposite sides of this huge lens, close to the edge, were 2 small but comfortable benches curved to follow the circumference. I was invited to sit on one of these and Firkn sat beside me to explain what was going on. Ram took a place on the opposite bench, while Orthon went to the control panels. These were located against the outer wall between the 2 benches, directly opposite the now invisible door through which we had entered the scout. When we were seated, a small flexible bar fell into place across our middles. This bar was either composed of, or merely covered with, a kind of soft rubberized material. Its purpose was obvious, a simple safety device to prevent falling forward or losing balance. Firkn explained, sometimes, when a ship is thoroughly grounded, A sharp jerk is experienced when breaking contact with Earth. Although this does not very often happen, we are always prepared. He smiled and added, the same principle exactly as the safety belts in your own planes. It was still difficult to believe that anything so wonderful was actually happening to me. Ever since my first meeting with the Venusian, after he had gone and I was left with an unutterable sense of loss and a longing to go with him, I had hoped and dreamed that one day such a privilege might be mine. Now that it seemed certain we were preparing for a journey into space, I could scarcely contain my joy. Again and again I reminded myself that I must memorize all that I would see and learn, that I might share my experience with others, however inadequately. This ship, Firkin continued, was built for a two-man crew, or three at the most. But in an emergency a great many more can be safely crowded into it. However, this is not often necessary. He did not explain further and I wondered if by emergency he could mean a rescue mission should another scout find itself in trouble. So impressed was I by this first-hand viewing of the amazing results of their scientific knowledge that it was almost impossible to visualize failure of any description. I had to remind myself that, after all, they too were human beings and, no matter how far advanced beyond us, must still be subject to error and vicissitude. I turned my attention to the graphs and charts that covered the walls for about 3 feet on either side of the door that I could not see, and which stretched from floor to ceiling. They were fascinating, entirely different from anything I had seen on Earth, and I tried to guess their purposes. There were no needles or dials, but flashes of changing colors and intensities. Some of these were like colored lines moving across the face of a particular chart. Some moved up and down, others crisscross, while still others took the forms of different geometric figures. The meanings and functions were not explained to me, and I doubt if I could have understood it all, but I noticed that all three of my companions were alert to the changes taking place. I received the impression that the instruments indicated, among other things, direction of travel, the approach of any other object, as well as atmospheric or space conditions. The wall for a distance of about 10 feet directly behind the benches on which we sat appeared to be solid and blank, while on those beyond, opposite our point of entry, were other charts somewhat similar, yet differing in certain ways from those I have described. The pilot's instrument board was unlike anything I could have imagined. The best comparison I can think of is that it looked rather like an organ. But instead of keys and stops there were rows of buttons. Small lights shone directly on these, so placed that each illuminated 5 buttons at a time. As far as I can remember, there were 6 rows of these buttons, each row about 6 feet long. In front of this board was a pilot's seat, very similar to the benches on which the rest of us were sitting. Close beside this bench, conveniently placed for easy use by the pilot, was a peculiar instrument connected directly to the central magnetic pole. Firkin corroborated my unspoken guess as to its use by saying, "Yes, that is a periscope, something like those used on your submarines." As I watched the various lights flashing across the faces of the charts and wall graphs, now increasing, now diminishing in intensity, it became quite clear why these translucent ships are so often reported as changing color as they move through our skies. But there are other contributing factors. Many of the color changes and the glowing coronas which often surround the saucers are the result of differing intensities of energy radiating out into the atmosphere and making it luminous directly surrounding the ships, due to a process somewhat similar to ionization. Within the craft there was not a single dark corner. I could not make out where the light was coming from. It seemed to permeate every cavity and corner with a soft, pleasing glow. There is no way of describing that light exactly. It was not white, nor was it blue, nor was it exactly any other color that I could name. Instead, it seemed to consist of a mellow blend of all colors, though at times I fancied one or another seemed to predominate. I was so engrossed in trying to solve this mystery, and at the same time to see and absorb every detail of this amazing little craft that I was quite unaware we had taken off, although I did suddenly register a slight feeling of movement. But there was no sensation of enormous acceleration, nor of changes in pressure and altitude as would be the case in one of our planes going at half the speed. Nor had we experienced any jerk as we broke contact with the ground. I had an impression of tremendous solidity and smoothness, with little more realization of movement than of the unnoticeable journey of the Earth itself as it revolves around the Sun at 18.5 miles per second. Others who have been privileged to ride in these saucers also have been struck by the same sensation of movement, or rather, the almost total lack of it. But the fact is, with so many wonders crowding my consciousness, it was only later, after I was back on Earth reviewing the night's experiences in my own mind, that I could begin to sort them out. My attention was now called to the big lens at my feet. An amazing sight met my eyes. We appeared to be skimming the rooftops of a small town. I could identify objects as though we were no more than 100 feet above the ground. It was explained to me that actually we were a good 2 miles up and still rising, but this optical device had such magnifying power that single persons could be picked out and studied, if so desired, even when the craft was many miles high and out of sight. The central pillar or magnetic pole serves a double purpose, explained my bench companion. Besides providing most of the power for flight, it also serves as a powerful telescope with one end pointing up through the dome to view the sky, and the other pointing down through the floor to inspect the land below. Images are projected through it into the two big lenses in the floor and ceiling, as you can see. He did not explain whether this was done electronically or by some other means. Its magnifications could be varied at will, and I suspect that there was more to it than a simple optical system such as we know on Earth. I looked up into the translucent dome. The stars had always looked near enough to touch in the clear air of my mountain home, but viewed through this ceiling lens they seemed to be actually on top of us. As I alternated between watching the wonders of the sky and the swift Earth flashing beneath us, I noticed 4 cables which appeared to run through the floor lens, or immediately below it, joining the central pole in the form of a cross. The Martian, noting my change of interest, explained, 3 of those cables carry power from the magnetic pole to the 3 balls under the ship which, as you have seen, are sometimes used as landing gear. These balls are hollow and, although they can be lowered for emergency landing and retracted when in flight, their most important purpose is as condensers for the static electricity sent to them from the magnetic pole. This power is present everywhere in the universe. One of its natural but concentrated manifestations is seen displayed as lightning. The 4th cable, he continued, extends from the pole to the 2 periscope-like instruments, the one beside the pilot's seat and the other directly behind his seat but close to the edge of the center lens, as you can see. These instruments are really extensions of the main optical system and enable the pilot to see everything that is going on without leaving his seat. They can be switched on and off, or adjusted at will, so that both members of the usual crew can have full use of the telescope without interfering with each other. All the machinery was beneath the floor of this compartment, and under the outer flange, as clearly shown in the photograph of this scout. I did not actually see any of it, but I was shown into a very small room which served both as an entrance to the compartment which contained the machinery, and as a workshop for emergency repairs. Here there was a tiny forge and a few storage cupboards in which, I surmised, necessary tools and materials would be kept. It was while I was looking through the door into this room that our pilot said, "Be prepared for landing. We are near our mother ship." I could not believe it. It seemed that only a few minutes had sped by since we had entered the scout. Just a moment earlier the wall behind the bench on which we had been sitting had appeared solid. Now a round hole began to appear. I watched in astonishment while it continued to open, rather like the iris of a camera. Shortly, a porthole about 18 inches wide appeared. This, then, explained the portholes in my saucer photographs, of which till now I had seen no sign. Like the door by which we had entered, their coverings fitted so closely as to be undetectable when closed. Recalling what my photos had shown, I reasoned that there must be 4 portholes on each side, making a total of 8. "That is correct," Arthur nodded in corroboration, "and the touch of a button can open them all or singly, and of course they are closed in the same manner." As the pilot alerted us to our impending landing, the Martian said, "You will be interested to watch this.